This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello and welcome to Rabble Radio. I'm Megan Perry. Halloween, in all its gore and its glory, is almost upon us. And as any progressive knows, some ideas just will not die. We'll talk about a few of those conceptual zombies with Jeet here. Another thing that just doesn't seem to fade away is the sexualization of girls. A feminist scholar addresses the issue during an interview about the death of Amanda Todd. And if you had to choose between studying the building blocks of the universe and going on an international bike ride, which would you choose? Philip Shepherd tells his story. And finally, we'll hear the best song ever written about an F-35 fighter jet. But first, from Guantanamo to Canada. On September 29th, Omar Khadr was brought back to Canada from the U.S. military prison where he'd been held for a decade. Legal scholars and activists avidly followed his case while the Canadian citizen was imprisoned at Guantanamo, and a new book of writing called Omar Khadr, O Canada, examines his story and the political and legal issues it reveals. 10 days before Khadr's return, contributors to the book held a launch in Vancouver. They debated and discussed the importance of Khadr's story and what it means for Canada and for Canadian citizens worldwide. Legal scholar Grace Wu was part of the discussion. Here's some of what she had to say.
The Federal Court and the Federal Court of Appeal both gave impeccably written reasons. All the Supreme Court of Canada had to do was refuse leave to appeal to those cases. Why it didn't, I don't know, because they refused leave to appeal to the majority of cases that people bring to the court. They should have left well enough alone. They were good decisions. Instead, what the Supreme Court of Canada chose to do was to undermine the very foundations of democracy and the rule of law. And that's what I find most disturbing. Apparently, it did this at the behest of our Department of Justice. And this raises a number of questions about how the Department of Justice functions. Why was there public money? Why is the Department of Justice being used to come up with arguments that go against the will of Parliament, that go against conventions that have been signed by Canada and by the majority of nations internationally, so that it has become imperative law that everyone must follow? Why would our Department of Justice be working on such a thing? Why would they make arguments that violate the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Canadian law, and international human rights? Why would they be working on that? That I don't understand.
That was Grace Wu, legal scholar and contributor to the book Omar Khadr, O Canada. It is edited by University of Alberta professor Janice Williamson, and you can hear the full discussion by tuning in to the Red Eye podcast. Just go to rabble.ca/podcasts and click the link to Red Eye. November marks the second anniversary of a now notorious article in Maclean's magazine's 2010 campus issue. It was titled, "Too Asian?" That article sparked anger across Canada over how racialized people are perceived and treated in Canada's educational institutions. "Too Asian, Race, Privilege, and Post-Secondary Education" is one book that sprang out of the controversy. Jeet here contributed to and co-edited the compilation. Here he is, speaking with Matt Adams.
This is 2 years old, this article, "Too Asian." So why should we be talking about this now? Why is it worth having a book 2 years out?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a question we really asked ourselves when we were putting together the book. On the one hand, the "Too Asian" article was very offensive to many people, and there's all sorts of protests all over the country by activists on many campuses, you know, going from Vancouver to the East Coast, and also many protests on the municipal level, with many municipalities condemning the article as well. On the other hand, it is one article, but like as I sort of the editors and I, as we were looking at the sort of the level of protest that it was generating, really came to the conclusion that the article wasn't just bad in and of itself. It was emblematic of larger problems both in the Canadian media. This is certainly not the first time that Maclean's has published a xenophobic article, and certainly not the first time any Canadian media has tried to portray immigrant groups as alien or foreign to Canada, but also problems in the way that race gets discussed, and also emblematic of certain anxieties people have in terms of, you know, Canada's changing demographics and the way that changing demographic shows up on the college campus. So in some ways, it's like, you know, trying to see the world in a grain of sand, that this one article stands in for a whole larger set of issues. I was also really struck by the fact that the Maclean's article had several prominent defenders in the Canadian media.
For sure.
People like Margaret Wente, Barbara Kay, there were a couple of others. And that also really was very interesting, because I think that these defenses of Maclean's showed that there's a wider problem in the media, and also that the way that they framed it, there's an attitude in a lot of the Canadian, the more conservative Canadian media, which I think can be described as sort of anti-racism. Like, they're not like making racist arguments per se, but they're very hostile to anti-racist activism. They want to argue that racism is not a problem. And in fact, the real problem are these minority groups and others who are raising the issue of racism. And the real victims are white men. I mean, these are all kind of like a set of attitudes that you really see in the defenses of Maclean's. And I thought, and the other co-editors agree, that this is also something worth tackling.
So, and then you bring up sort of the notion of the role of the media. And, you know, some people in the book talk about the sort of infamous W5 episode that came out years ago. Maybe you could touch on that a little bit. But also, you know, the continuing issues around people like Margaret Wente and sort of her troubles recently. Like, why is that? How does the book connect to that sort of specific media criticism, the role of media criticism in all this?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, you're right that the Maclean's article in our book and in activism in general has been very correctly linked to the earlier W5 program from the late 1970s, where the TV show, in pretty much exactly the same terms as the Maclean's, showed Asian Canadian kids, I think in that case predominantly Chinese Canadian, but saw them as being a problem on campus because they're taking positions away from Canadian students, with the supposition that to be Chinese Canadian is not to be a real Canadian. And the Maclean's article, in a lot of ways, is almost like a word-for-word revival of the W5 thing. And,
so it's plagiarism in spirit.
Plagiarism in spirit, yeah, yeah. Well, it's, so there's, I mean, there's that aspect that this, so that this is something that, you know, hasn't happened just once, but sort of repeatedly happens. These arguments are repeated, they're zombie arguments. They keep coming back from the dead, no matter how often they're refuted. And so, as in a zombie movie, you have to kill zombies. That's just the way it is. But I mean, the other issue is also like the one of sort of media criticism, where which came out up again with the recent fact that Margaret Wente was demonstrated to be a plagiarist, and there was a real reluctance on the part of the Globe and Mail, her employer, to be upfront about this fact, and furthermore, a real reluctance on the part of the Canadian media to criticize her in accurate terms. And I think what the current Wente case shows, as with the earlier Maclean's Two Asian thing, is that there's a real dearth of media criticism in the mainstream media. And all the sort of media criticism that really came out of against the Maclean's article, not all of it, but I'd say like 95% of it came from outside the media. It came from activists and university students and university professors, and with the Wente as well. I mean, it's very interesting that the Margaret Wente was not shown to be a plagiarist by a fellow journalist. She was shown to be a plagiarist by a blogger who's an academic and painter living in Ottawa, who, like, in very calm, reasonable terms, over the period of a year and a half, documented Margaret Wente plagiarizing articles. And it took a long, long time for that these accusations, which were very well-founded and documented, to make it into the Canadian media. And it was only through sort of what one could call extra journalistic means, through blogging and through Twitter, that the plagiarism issue became an issue. And I think with the Two Asian as well, it's only because of activism that this article has been challenged. If we had to rely on the Canadian media to police itself, you know, we're in a very dire situation indeed.
That was Jeet here, co-editor of a new book called Two Asian, Race, Privilege, and Post-Secondary Education. To listen to the entire interview, why not click your way over to the Radio Book Lounge? You do that by heading to rabble.ca/podcasts and clicking the link to Radio Book Lounge. You might hear more about zombie ideas, but don't be scared. We can fight them. When actor and author Philip Shepherd was a young man, he was prepared to go to school in physics. He gathered up his pencils and his calculators. Then he bought a bicycle and traveled to Japan to study no theater instead. Here he is, explaining how he made that choice, to interviewer Lynn Thompson, with a flock of boisterous seagulls in the background.
You know, I was 18 at the time. I was standing at a fork in the road. One fork, I'd been accepted at the University of Toronto to study physics at Trinity College. And you know what? It was so laid out. You go to school, you get a career, you marry, you get a house, you have kids. And it was just all so ready for me. And then there was this other fork in the road that led to Japan. And I had read some ancient treatises from classical Japanese no theater. And to my young mind, they seemed to say metaphorically everything that needed to be said about art. And one of these performances actually came to Montreal in 1971. And I got on a Greyhound bus and went to Montreal and saw this Japanese performance. I was so deeply moved by it. I was in tears and at the same time profoundly baffled. And what I mean by that is I'd seen the best that Western theater had to offer. I'd seen Sir John Gielgud and Sir Ralph Richardson in a play called Home in London, England. A phenomenal theater. I'd been involved in a theater downtown in Toronto for 2 years. I'd studied theater, and here was this form of theater that I could not begin to parse. It profoundly moved me, and I had no idea how this was being wrought. So, physics, no theater. I think one of the reasons I chose no theater was because it more profoundly baffled me than physics did.
That was Philip Shepherd talking about his journey in Japan and the impact it had on his life. To hear more about Philip's cycling trip, you can head for the Living on Purpose podcast. You'll find that link at rabble.ca/podcasts. You know, I love Halloween. But every year, one thing that gets my goat is the prevalence of sexy this and sexy that costumes, even for young girls. Many feminists, me included, would say that these costumes are part of a larger culture of sexual harassment and misogyny. During an interview about the tragic suicide of Amanda Todd, Megan Murphy asked political writer and social commentator Melinda Tankard Reist about the rising mainstream trend of sexualizing girls.
Girls are being raised in a culture that rewards exhibitionism. Everything is filmed, everything is documented, everything is recorded. You know, recently there was this Facebook phenomenon called naked selfies, where girls were encouraged to post naked images of themselves, or other people were publishing images of the girls with or without their permission. This is on the rise everywhere, and so girls are being told to measure their worth through what they can offer sexually, that they have to be publicly sexual, to be publicly sexually attractive, to receive a value and validation. We just saw this year in research from the UK that even 6-year-olds thought they had to be sexy. They were shown two images of girls, and the sexier one was the most popular. The girls thought she would have the most friends, and she was the character that they most wanted to be like. So girls are absorbing these messages from the youngest of ages.
That was Melinda Tankard-Reist reflecting on the sexualization of girls. To hear the rest of that interview, head for Rabble.ca's podcast, The Feminist Current. That podcast can be found, you guessed it, at rabble.ca/podcasts. Now, if you want to take a pass on wearing a sexy costume this year, I have an idea for you. Just be Big Bird, for goodness sakes. And if I may, I'd like to take a moment to direct you to a website that has many, many excellent costume ideas for women. It's here. It's called takebackhalloween.org. Sexy isn't always fun, and fun isn't always sexy. Now there's a scary thought for Halloween. Addie Sarah Kreindler is a singer-songwriter and a fan of musical satire. In her compositions, the satirical warbler has ridiculed the conservative government, pipelines, and cuts to old-age security. Now, she's blasting the F-35s. Here she is on the Red Eye podcast, talking music and social change. Take it away, Addie.
So I grew up very much in musical theater, originally Gilbert and Sullivan. I was a big fan of the Mikado when I was four. Gilbert and Sullivan is very good for four-year-olds because the plots are extremely silly. So I just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And I think that stayed with me, that doing music is just a natural part of doing comedy.
And where does the satire fit in?
Well, you just mentioned my passion for politics and social justice, and it's true. That's something that's been part of my life for a long time. Even, I guess, if you look at the roots in childhood, being bullied or seeing other kids bullied and wanting to take a stand, and getting older, recognizing that the bullies are often forces in our political system, our economic system, and wanting to speak out against that and raise awareness.
Now, satire is often very, very satisfying for the for the people listening to kind of hear something that they maybe feel angry about and hear it ridiculed. What does it do for you?
I think very much a similar thing. As a songwriter, I've got I do lyrical and I do satirical, and I guess it's often out of emotion. If it's love, I write a sad song. If I'm angry, I write a funny song. If it's love and anger, I write a funny song about my own side. So there is certainly an emotional release in writing as well as the desire to communicate.
Now, you mentioned Gilbert and Sullivan as a musical instrument, influence from a very early age. What other kinds of influences do you draw on?
Satirically, Tom Lehrer would have to be the big influence. I got familiar with his message also, with his music, also fairly young, and really, really admired both just the intelligence and the way he writes, but also the way he found the perfect musical style for the thing he was planning to communicate. So early on, when I was in my teens and really, really wanting to write satire, I drew on that very much, thinking, what style would Tom Lehrer use for this?
Now, we're going to play your song, Salute to the F-35s. Can you talk about what inspired you to write this song?
Sure. Well, a little while back, there was a big flap in the media, because the conservative government had committed to buying these state-of-the-art F-35 warplanes and tried to convince the public that the cost was going to be about $16 billion, and it turned out they were just about $10 billion out. So, the idea of the lie and the cover-up was very much a scandal. But to me, the deeper issue was, what does it say about our priorities when we're cutting left and right, we're cutting old-age security, we're cutting, even little programs for youth like Getimovic, that's $14 million. And yet we have money for this military expenditure, and we can afford to be so cavalier about the cost.
Okay, well, let's listen to Salute to the F-35s.
Don't stop the cutbacks. We have no regrets. We know the true priority is fighter jets. Let the seniors starve. Let the poor take the pain. We must all our choices and our choice is plain. Let us fire food inspectors, they'll drain the public purse. If you swallow that story, E. coli won't be worse. Let the jobless wait in a line that never ends while we hand out the contracts to our corporate friends. So look out, social programs, we're getting out the knives. All we need is our F-35. lodge. So when caught in a lie, he just looked at the sky and sung as he hung the civil service out to dry. Let the critics shout as the pressure keeps mounting. It's only a 10 billion difference in accounting. So smile, 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 and let's get out the checks, 'cause there's just one aircraft that can beat our bogus specs. It's our one luxury in tough times, plus the prisons we're building for those unreported crimes. Let our hearts swell with pride as a brand new day arrives. All we need is our F-35s. When the poor and the helpless are fighting for their lives, we can let them eat F-35s.
Those beautiful pipes belong to Addie Sarah Kreindler. She performs a few other tunes in that episode of Red Eye as well, and Immigration Minister Jason Kenney is not spared. Why not check those numbers out for yourself? You can listen in by clicking the link to Red Eye at rabble.ca/podcasts. And with that, we come to the end of this Halloween episode of Rabble Radio. It's been a long break, but I'm happy to be back. Thanks to the Rabble.ca podcasters who contributed to the program, the Red Eye Collective, Megan Murphy, and Lynn Thompson. Our theme was composed by Bob Wiseman. Matt Adams is the brand new producer. It is great to have you on board, Matt. And the executive producer of Rabble Radio is me, Megan Perry. We'll talk to you again soon. Happy Halloween!